Good evening. Please, leave the light on. Christmas is coming, and the choristers are getting thin. Why should this concern us? Tonight, our vigil among the thirsty undead is spent in the company of Robert Swindles, and his story, A Lot of Mince Pies, will explain. Swindles masquerades as a children's author, but it might not be a good idea to let your children listen to what follows. Unless, in a few hours from now, you are happy to be woken by their nightmares. I wish to God I'd never heard of the school choir, and I'm not the only one. In 3 days' time, we'll go caroling round the village, same as every year. We'll work our melodious way along the high street, trekking up gravel driveways to do our stuff and knock for donations. All proceeds to local charities. We'll do all the posh houses on Mickleborough Close, then the Red Lion and the supermarket car park. The supermarket will be seething with last-minute shoppers, as it always is on Christmas Eve. We never fail to make a killing there. And after that, we'll move out to where the street lamps end and do some of the cottages and a farm or two. The cottages are a dead loss as far as money's concerned, but school choirs have sung outside them since just after the dinosaurs, and we carry on the tradition. The farms are better. They know we're coming, so they keep the dogs in and do hot mince pies and ginger wine for us. I can't stand mince pies. Anyway, from the minute we troop out of the schoolyard behind old Exley at 7 o'clock, the kids will be waiting for one thing. They'll be waiting for the last house. The Milton's place, with its tangled garden, crumbling brick and funny little windows. It's 3/4 of a mile from the village, and the choir usually gets there about 9 o'clock. The Miltons will be waiting, and as soon as we strike up the first number, they'll open the door and stand there in carpet slippers, smiling and swaying a little to the music. They're the most ancient couple you're ever likely to see. My mum says they were old when she was in the choir, but the thing about them is, you can actually see that they're enjoying the carols. And afterwards, they make a generous donation and give presents to all the kids. There's always 18 in the choir, and I suppose the Meltons buy the stuff on their Christmas shopping expedition, but I don't know where they go. Nobody ever sees them in the village. The presents aren't tatty either. None of your quid a dozen made in Taiwan plastic rubbish. They tend to be things like cartridge pens, pen knives and wallets and purses made of real leather. Last year, I got a calculator. As soon as the singing's over, they beckon some kid inside, someone whose face they've taken a fancy to, I suppose, and the chosen one reappears a few minutes later with a double armful of little packets. By now, you'll be thinking this sounds like the perfect end to Christmas Eve and wondering why I'm moaning. Hang about, and I'll tell you what happened last year. It was a clear, starry night, and the hoar frost was already forming on the grass as we left the last of the farms behind and set off to sing for the Meltons. We got to the Meltons' place at 9:10. One downstairs window strained pale light through its curtain, but the garden was black. "Right, folks," old Exley whispered. He only called us folks on Christmas Eve. "Hark the herald after two." He counted us in, and we were away. They must have been waiting behind the door, because halfway through line 3, the latch clicked and it swung inwards, and there they were. Him with his arm round her shoulder, nodding in time with the music. You couldn't tell if they were smiling because what light there was behind them, but you got the impression that they were. Our last number was We Wish You a Merry Christmas. Nobody could accuse us of originality. As the final note died away, the Meltons clapped. They always did that. The old guy flapped a hand and said, "Let that one come in. The one with the bubble cap." We were all bunched together, so you couldn't tell who he meant, and I'd forgotten I had my pom-pom hat on, so I didn't move. Old Exley craned over the kids' heads, trying to see where old Milton was pointing. He spotted my pom-pom and said, "Wake up, lad. The gentleman's waiting." I hurried forward, feeling myself go red. As I did so, this third-year girl, Stephanie Williams, said something I didn't catch and made a half-hearted grab for my sleeve. She had a funny look on her face, but she's a peculiar girl at the best of times, and I just sort of jerked my arm out of her reach and brushed past. It wasn't till I was inside with my hat in my hand that I remembered Stephanie had been the chosen one last year. I was standing in a stone-flagged passageway. To my left, a door stood ajar. Light trickled feebly from beyond it, falling in a wedge across the flags. I saw slug trails, and there was a flat, fungoid smell. The old woman slipped a hand under my elbow and began steering me along the passageway. Beyond the puddle of light, I was virtually blind. Behind me, the old man closed the door. "This way, my dear." The woman guided me to the foot of some wooden stairs that went up into blackness. I didn't want to insult them or hurt their feelings or anything, but the creepiness of the place was getting to me, and I hung back a bit. "Is there a light?" I ventured. "Oh, no, dear." She sounded surprised, shocked almost. The old man, shuffling after us, said,
"He can't do with the light, you see."
"Who?" My scalp prickled. We began climbing the uncarpeted stairs.
"Why, Gilbert, of course," said the woman. "Our little son. He can't do with it, can he, Daddy?"
"No, Mummy," her husband replied. "He's a good boy, but he can't do with a light at all."
I said, "I didn't know you had a boy." My voice sounded shaky even to me.
"A long, long time, Mummy,"
old Melton confirmed, and it occurred to me that they were probably mad. It was Christmas Eve, and here I was in the dark with a pair of decrepit lunatics who thought they had a kid called Gilbert. At the top of the stairs was a creaky landing. It was not completely dark, because there was a door with about an inch of bluish light showing under it. Mrs. Melton let go my arm and whispered,
"Gilbert's room. I'll open the door and you can pop in and give him his present."
"Present?" A mixture of dread and embarrassment scrambled my brain. I had no present. Was I supposed to have? Perhaps a gift for Gilbert was part of the yearly ritual. If so, nobody had told me. I flushed in the chill gloom, stammering, I'm sorry, Mrs. Melton, I didn't know. I haven't..."
"Yes, you have."
I started as the old man, who must have crept up behind me, hissed in my ear. His breath smelled vile. The only thing I had was my hat, now a damp, screwed-up lump in my hand. I remembered he'd mentioned it outside, the one with the bobble cap. Stupidly, I held it out.
"This? You mean this?"
He chuckled.
"A kiss," he whispered. "Only a kiss under the mistletoe."
"I'm a boy," I croaked, appalled. "I don't kiss other boys." He didn't reply. The woman stretched up and drew a bolt near the top of the door. It grated and slammed. As the echo died, I heard something else. An uncouth, wordless cry from the room beyond, and I knew then that Gilbert was real and that there must be something horribly wrong with him. She bent and drew a second bolt. I don't know why I didn't turn then and run. I'll never know. I only know I've spent every day since wishing I had. The door swung inward.
"Gilbert," the woman crooned. "Here's somebody with a present for you, darling."
I couldn't see past her. The old man laid an arm across my shoulders and pushed me forward. I was half resisting, and he really had to exert pressure. He kept murmuring, "Come along, come along," as though he was talking to a stubborn infant. If I dug my heels in, he wouldn't have stood a chance. But even now, a part of me was scared of hurting their feelings. A mistletoe kiss seems such a small thing, and how do you tell parents nicely that the thought of being in the same room with their kid makes you want to throw up, let alone kissing him? The woman moved aside. There was a bed. Above the bed, a dim blue light bulb burned. Somebody had fastened a sprig of mistletoe to its dusty, fraying flecks. The light fell on rumpled sheets, and on the boy they called Gilbert. I gaped. God knows what I'd been expecting. Some slavering, semi-human monster, I suppose, but Gilbert was beautiful. I know it's a funny word to use about a boy, but he was. He lay, propped on one elbow, looking at me through dark,
liquid lemur's eyes. His tip-tilted nose cast a smudge of shadow across a mobile mouth. His hair fell in a dark cascade to his shoulders, concealing the hand that supported his head. His frame was lean, his pale skin smooth as cream. Old Melton dropped his hand to the small of my back and pushed gently.
"Go on now, boy. One little kiss, that's all."
I moved towards the bed, but it wasn't the old man's hand that made me. It was partly relief, of course, relief that I wasn't about to touch some unspeakable horror with my lips, but mostly it was Gilbert's eyes. I read a bit once out of a book my mum was reading. It was a romance, and somebody was going on about drowning in someone's eyes. It struck me as daft at the time, but now, when I try to figure out why I permitted what happened that night to happen, I remember Gilbert's eyes, and I think I know what that writer meant. Anyway, I found myself standing by the bed, and I couldn't tear my eyes away from his. He didn't say anything, but he made a motion with his head, and I knew he wanted me to kneel down. I felt sick and weak and unreal. Then Gilbert leant forward, and his lips parted, and I saw why he couldn't talk. His mouth was crammed with spikes. As soon as I saw that mouth, I knew what he was. But by then it was too late. He took what he wanted from me, and now I'm one of them. Like Stephanie Williams and the other chosen. We all make the trip out to the Melton place once a month, each on a separate night, of course. We have to go, or we die like everybody else. I expect you're wondering what it's like. Well, you don't feel that much different, really, except you've no energy and the light hurts, and you see colours as sort of faded. There are a lot more of us about than you think, by the way. So many that you're bound to know at least one. He'll be pasty-faced and a bit flabby and not too particular about his clothes. He'll be irritable a lot of the time and he won't smile much. You'll probably wonder what he does for fun, or even if he knows what fun is. You might wonder why he bothers to go on living at all. And he'll certainly wonder himself sometimes. I do. And I suppose the answer is that life's precious, and we tend to cling on to it even if we're not enjoying it. Whether I'll feel that way 1,000 years from now remains to be seen. 1,000 years is a lot of mince pies. Sleep well, if you can.
David Tennant was the reader, and the stories are abridged by Robin Brooks. It was produced by Clive Brill for Pacificus Productions and BBC Radio 4.